has suffered another setback. NPR's Joel Rose reports the Federal Communications Commission is moving to block the $39 billion deal.
The FCC says the deal would result in job losses and higher prices for consumers. It's an unusual move for the commission, which hasn't tried to block a merger in almost 10 years. AT&T now faces opposition from two government agencies. The Justice Department has already sued to block the merger. That case is scheduled to go before a federal judge in February. AT&T had tried to persuade regulators that the merger would result in more jobs, not less, but the FCC was apparently not convinced. A spokesman for AT&T called the decision disappointing. Joel Rose, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 168 points. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes in communities worldwide and supporting World Diabetes Day. NovoNordisk-US.com.
Ensure that Illinois Public Media will be able to provide your children and grandchildren with the breadth of programs and services that you treasure. Leave your own legacy for them by making a gift through your estate for WILL. It's simple and easy. What a difference you can make to future generations. Simply call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or online for more information at will.illinois.edu/support. Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois. Donated blood saves the lives of the injured and critically ill. There are no substitutes for donated blood, and donation takes only 45 minutes. Blood donation. It's about life. More information is on the web at bloodservices.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Both of the programs today come from the Focus Archives. We hope you will enjoy listening. Perhaps you're hearing these programs for the first time. We are going to then take a couple of days off, and we'll be back on our regular schedule with new live shows on Monday. So this first hour is a program that we first broadcast in September. And as you listen, keep in mind that for this morning, we'll not be taking calls. In the years since 9/11, a great deal has been written about the way that New York's World Trade Center was destroyed. In this hour of a show, we want to do something a little bit different. We want to talk about the way that these buildings were created. And our guest for the program is Eric Darton. He is a cultural historian and fiction writer. He is a native New Yorker, and he is author of the book Divided We Stand. The subtitle is A Biography of the World Trade Center. This is a book that was first published in 1999 and now has been republished with a new introduction and afterword by the author. It's out in paper now, published by Basic Books. It takes a look at how it is the towers were developed, perhaps what that says about the city of New York, maybe something about what these buildings said about architecture, and also about how, in the process of our conversation, I'm sure we'll talk about how it is that people's feelings about these buildings changed as a result of their destruction. Just a little bit more about our guest. He is also a novelist. He's the author of the critically acclaimed novel Free City. His essays and stories have been widely published and anthologized. He's taught media studies at Hunter College and Fordham University and writing at Goddard College and New York University. And he's joining us this morning by phone. And Eric Darton, hello.
Hey, hello.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. We really appreciate it.
It's good to be here.
I want to talk a little bit maybe about the history of the book first and to have you think back to the 90s, whenever it was you actually started thinking about writing it and started writing it. What was it that made you want to write this book at that point?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and every time I think about it, it comes out a little different. It goes actually back before the 90s. It goes back to, you know, really a moment in the late 1960s, probably early 1970s, when I was happened to be in Lower Manhattan and for the first time registered the steelwork of the Twin Towers as they were going up and saw them from a certain angle at a particular moment in the morning when the sun was kind of, you know, glinting off them, and it was like, wow. In New York, as I'm sure in anyone who lives in a really highly developed urban area, lots of stuff goes on, and you sort of just weave it into the mix as you go. You know, like a street is closed, you kind of go around it. We're very adaptable creatures, and, you know, big buildings get built all the time, subways get dug, all kinds of stuff happens. But then something occasionally, rarely, cuts through, and you go, wow, that's different. That I haven't seen. And this was one of those moments, and this was in, like, 1960s, and I think I was very involved in various forms of political activity, anti-war movements, and all kinds of things. And I think I just filed it in my imagination, and it was, wow, this is different. And then a whole bunch of years later, when I was in graduate school at Hunter College, I took my sweet time getting my education. It took a long time. I had to do a dissertation, and I wanted to do something about the built environment. I didn't want to do something too theoretical. I wanted to do something about the city I'd grown up in. I looked around I was in a media studies program, and I looked around for things that had been done that really served as kind of paradigm shifts. You could say that the Empire State, or any number of paradigm shifts happen in any kind of great metropolis. And I started looking at the World Trade Center, and one of the first things I realized was that there was no bibliography. There had been, in fact, a kind of a press release-y book published many years in the past by the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey, the agency that built the World Trade Center. But there really was no biography. And the architect of the World Trade Center similarly fell between the cracks. He was neither a modernist nor a postmodernist. There was a whole bunch of things where suddenly it occurred to me that this enormous intervention in the city, this huge thing, essentially had no real biography. It had no bibliography either, nor had many of the key people who had developed it. It had happened almost without having an actual history, although as I researched more and more, I realized that it had been reported on extensively. But somehow it had kind of managed to escape a lot of notice. And that was like, whoa, you mean I could own this? And it was a very exciting feeling to begin work on that, and that was in 1992. And then a few months later, as I began to put together the rudiments of the process, it was a little bit like finding the bones of a dinosaur and kind of going, gee, what is this? And it's big, but what is it? Then in February 1993, the first bombing happened. And that was one of those funny moments where you either back away from something because it's altogether too big and too scary, or you commit yourself further. And it goes without saying that I committed myself further because the book is the proof of that. But in a way, in the back of my mind, this vision of the towers back in the 60s and early 70s stayed with me because there was something very anomalous about these buildings. In a city of skyscrapers, these were different. And that difference is eventually what kind of, it was like a little bit of sand that got into my clamshell and eventually made me kind of produce this, it's for readers to decide whether the book is a pearl or not. But
nice metaphor, though. I like that a lot. Well, you know, one of the things that you have to, I'm sure that they were, incredibly dramatic. They were, at the time that they were built, they were the tallest buildings in the world. And I was really interested in this little detail that the Port Authority had this rule that said that any other building built there in the area around the towers could only be half as high. So at least there on that site, there would be no rivals to one and two, those two buildings. And I'm sure that even in a city that has a lot of tall buildings, these two buildings made a very dramatic statement.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they did. And aside from the fact that there would be no competitors in terms of actual height or mass, there's also the fact that these were extremely unusual buildings structurally. I'm not a structural engineer. I can't really address that. But this was a radical revision of the physical structure of a classic form, a form that had become classic, which was the skyscraper. And that was manifest actually in the physical structure of the engineering itself, but was also manifest to a very large extent in the visual element of it. The idea that the column structures on the outside of the building meant that the windows were not as wide and as they could be in most steel frame structures. And so what you ended up with was something that from not very far away looked as though it had no windows at all. It was like you were looking at some two squared off silos, more like looking at an abstract sculpture than at buildings that were inhabited by human beings. Then there was another curious element to it also, which is someone is in fact writing a book on him, an academic in Michigan is writing a book on the architect Minoru Yamasaki, who had built any number of different projects, and he certainly deserves his own book and maybe many. I do talk about him extensively in the book. He was hired by the world, Port Authority, out of an. He was not a top tier architect. He had the soul of an engineer. He had done some very interesting projects. But when they got him and gave him this amazing task of putting 10 million square feet in a very, very small space, he kind of went against many of his fundamental instincts to reject the tower, to reject the box as the modernist symbol, and came up against the fact that, well, he had to make a box, but he couldn't just make one gigantic box, so he made two gigantic boxes. And what ended up happening was there was a radical departure from the evolution of the skyscraper, which draws itself, I think, from many different sources. Other people have written about this very eloquently, but there's the sense of a fortress tower, but there's also the aspirational sense of a church or cathedral spire. And in fact, the Woolworth Building, one of the more famous buildings, in fact, it was in many respects the game changer of its day in 1913 when it was built. It was the equivalent in many respects of the World Trade Center. Nothing surpassed it either in height or mass for quite a long time after. But it was known as the Cathedral of Commerce. So it was a very direct association. It was the building, the Woolworth Building, had a very direct reference to Gothic architecture for a lot of reasons. So there's this aspirational quality to the skyscrapers, to many of the great ones that we've come to know as classics that have defined the skylines of the city in the early 20th century. And then what Yamasaki did and what the Port Authority do is kind of radically break with that, which is to say, we're going to have all the assertive qualities of a skyscraper, all the dominance of it, but we're not going to have the aspirational quality. We're not going to build it so that we can kind of imagine it drawing us up into heaven. So that when we looked at the World Trade Center, when we did, which many people didn't because it was so weird that you almost didn't want to look at it, or you looked at it and kind of like your eyes sort of glazed over it, and then you couldn't quite get the two buildings really in focus. It was like a kind of split retina. You could never see them in the same dimension. But they broke with the architectural tradition of the skyscraper by creating buildings that you couldn't see. The average skyscraper draws your eye up. Well, these sort of didn't do either. Were we going up? Were we going down? There were just these two things that looked like there had been legs and that there should be a body on top of it or there should be a spire on top of it. But suddenly, there was no information. At a certain height, arbitrarily, no information. Hmm. Were we going up? Were we going down? A number of years after Yamasaki designed the World Trade Center, two or three years, he designed a bank in Washington, in Seattle, Rainier Bank, where he took a similar kind of a box structure as the World Trade Center, a single tower, and he did put a spire on it, except the spire was at the bottom. And so what you basically have, if you look at this in Seattle, is a building that essentially comes out of, he took a skyscraper and turned it on its head. This is several years afterwards. And now you see a building definitely pointing down. I mean, it is objectively one of the scariest buildings in the world, and an architecture critic at the time called it Yamasaki's Balance of Terror. And this was in 1976. It was really clear. And so you can see in a way that for a lot of reasons, which I don't frankly even know the answer to, what you get in the World Trade Center is an enormously problematic building. And we haven't even talked about its effect on the city or the social forces that gave rise to it. But from a purely visual, symbolic, and architectural standpoint, you're dealing with something that no one's ever seen before. And you're dealing with it twice. It's not just one weird building, but two really weird buildings. And it's the twinness and the scale that combine to have made it, you know, one of the most disconcerting things that you could possibly put on a skyline.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Eric Darton. He's cultural historian and also fiction writer, and is the author of the book Divided We Stand, A Biography of the World Trade Center. This is a book that he actually published in 1999. Which has now been republished with a new introduction afterward. It's published in paper by Basic Books. Very interesting book, particularly if you're interested in the history of things like architecture and urban development. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to go on here and perhaps talk about the reaction to the buildings when they went up, because it is true that there was a lot of criticism. Many architects, urban planners, and so forth, really didn't like the building. What was your average New Yorker? I assume people went around and asked people, and I'm sure that they weren't shy about saying. What did people in New York think about these things?
Well, as always with New York, you know, you get a million answers, you know, depending on who you ask. You know, I mean, there is no – one of the great things about living in any great urban center is you're not going to get a unanimity on anything, you know. But one of the first things that happened with the World Trade Center is that a lot of the architecture critics were freaked because they had no reference for it. It was completely outside their box, and they didn't know what to do with it. And they didn't know what to do with Yamasaki, and they were just freaked out. It was big. It was being built by the agency, the public agency, the public authority that was supposed to be in charge of New York's port and its bridges and tunnels, and suddenly it was building 10 million square feet of real estate. So none of this really added up. And usually with us, when things don't really add up, we do one of two things. We either reject it and pretend it's not there, or we say we don't like it, or we find some way to domesticate it. And one way that people found to domesticate it was to call the buildings David and Nelson. Now, the reason for that, I'll make it quick. The buildings were perceived by many sort of savvy streetwise New Yorkers as David and Nelson because they were seen as the creatures of the Rockefeller brothers, David and Nelson Rockefeller. David was the head of the Chase Bank, or at the time of the Chase Manhattan Bank. And the Rockefeller family had an interesting history of real estate in New York. The first generation, John D. Rockefeller, the first generation we'll look at, built an amazing skyscraper at the foot of Lower Manhattan. Many people have come down there and seen the Battery, or they've seen the great bronze bull that symbolizes, you know, our bullishness down at the beginning of the financial center. But he built, when Standard Oil became the first billion-dollar corporation around the turn of the century, he built the Standard Oil headquarters at 25 Broadway at the very foot of Manhattan, very base of Manhattan, Bowling Green. The next generation, his son, John D. Jr., built this extraordinary thing, Rockefeller Center, in Midtown Manhattan. And because, unlike many cities, New York has a split central business district. We have a downtown and a midtown one, and we have a whole bunch of space in between that's not really a central business district. So there's been an oscillation back and forth between these two wings of the central business district, and the Rockefellers have had very heavy investments in both at different times. So John D. Jr. built Rockefeller Center, one of the iconic landmarks of New York City. And then his sons, David and Nelson, there are other sons as well, but these are the two who become involved in the World Trade Center project. Why David? Well, David had built Chase Plaza, the first major skyscraper in Lower Manhattan to be built since the Depression, a huge project, the new headquarters of Chase Manhattan. And in order to support the development and growth of the surrounding area, which was Lower Manhattan was widely perceived as kind of beginning to fall into disrepair and kind of not keeping pace with the modern city, David, among other planners, David Rockefeller, conceived of a plan to completely futuristically redesign Lower Manhattan along the lines of a gleaming kind of corporate paradise. And this was very much in line with the planning ethos of Robert Moses and others. And David ran and began, as head of Chase, something called the Downtown Lower Manhattan Association, the DLMA, which agitated in every conceivable way through media, through all kinds of – every resource was brought to bear to basically expand the financial district and modernize it and to create, again, downtown, a gleaming corporate futuropolis. And so David was really, really pushing that, and it also was pushing if indeed the value of the land in that area went up, that would support his enterprises as well. Nelson, his brother, was the governor of New York State. For people like the Rockefellers, having a politician, when what you really wanted to have was bankers and people kind of behind the scenes, was having a politician out there in the public eye was kind of a little déclassé, but there he was. And Nelson was the governor of New York State. And as the governor of New York State, he was one of the major players, if not the dominant player, in a bi-state agency, which I mentioned, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. What makes the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey interesting, several things do, is that it was founded quite early in the century to manage the port of New York, which was then the largest port and remained the largest port until it was essentially deported during the era of the World Trade Center. In a sense, you could almost say we lost a port and we gained this massive extension of the financial district. And what happened with the Port Authority is that essentially it is the creature of the New York and New Jersey legislatures. But in practice, the governors of the New York and New Jersey exert a great deal of influence over the Port Authority. And it's actually a very curious thing because it sort of says it goes beyond the sovereignty of the city or either of the two states and sort of says what's good for the region, what's good for this bi-state. The port is essentially a bi-state thing. It's the water flows everywhere. It flows in both states. So the Port Authority's role, it was developed to manage the port and to build bridges and tunnels to kind of facilitate port commerce, traffic, and the general well-being and life of the port, which was seen as the lifeblood of the city. It was seen as that until very recently. And even to some extent, even Wall Street had to kind of move aside and go, yeah, we're great, but wow, the port is even greater. I mean, we took over from London sometime in the 20th century as being the port of the world. And therefore also, to some extent, the gravitational center of world finance. So what ends up happening, curiously, is that Nelson, in order to do this gleaming corporate futuropolis, doesn't really quite work out. But what does happen is there is a possibility of developing a World Trade Center, which is essentially David's idea. And it's initially going to be over on the east side, where it's going to be something that looks a lot like the UN headquarters. And it's supposed to be kind of a big trade fair, but very gleaming and modernistic. But then for various reasons, that doesn't happen, because at the moment, there's no capacity to kind of put enough money or enough energy into that. And what ends up happening is the Port Authority gets involved because there's a bankrupt commuter rail line which goes between, that basically brings a lot of people to work in New York and is a real source of jobs and revenue. And it was going bankrupt, and the Port Authority got involved because they were now able to say, well, yeah, we want to get into the real estate game. We're kind of bored with bridges, tunnels, and running the port. We want to do a vertical port. We want to build the port of the future. The port of the future won't be a real port with stevedores and wharf rats. The port of the future will be like kind of a teleport, like a port that, you know, that and we'll build this vertical port. And they didn't know at the time that they were going to get these twin towers, but they did have space that they could condemn or felt that they could condemn over on the west side near this bankrupt railway, where this bankrupt railway tunnels came out, what's now called the Port Authority, the PATH trains, which were then called the Hudson Tubes. So the Port Authority got involved, and that did two really important things. One, it gave the World Trade Center a public purpose, because the Port Authority is a public agency. And it also meant that the development of this huge piece of speculative real estate was no longer dependent on the market per se or on banks per se, because the Port Authority had a virtually limitless capacity to issue bonds. And when you can sell bonds, you can sell. So the scale of this thing was only made possible, of the World Trade Center, as we know, was only made possible because of this intervention. And David and Nelson kind of came together and used their powers in a real kind of double play. It was a great double play, and then we got another vertical, you know, double play. But that's kind of how it worked. Mm. And that was when I was first tremendously struck by that, because you have a governor of a state, a public official, and then you have this enormously powerful guy in the world of private capital, and they are brothers, and they put their heads together, and then New Yorkers look and they go, oh yeah, David and Nelson. So unconsciously people put it together, and it's like, oh yeah, they're David and Nelson. And the towers, actually, there was a more posh tower, and there was a more proletarian tower. It was one that had a crown, and the other didn't have a crown. One had a spire on top for transmission, and one was, in order to give it a rent base, because there was no rent base for such a gigantic structure, Nelson Rockefeller, as governor, imported 50,000 workers to work in one tower at above market rents. Just said, hey, we'll just fill it with workers, state workers. And then gradually commercial tenants trickled up into Tower 1. fascinating, the whole story. I mean, even talking about it now, I'm like, whoa.
Well,
so much to do a book on
it. It is just an, just an amazing story, particularly when you talk about all of the various currents, political and economic currents here floating through the city, and how you end up with a public agency that was in the port business, then ending up big time in real estate and going from what initially, I think, if I understand this right, initially the idea was, well, they were going to build a building that was just going to be the headquarters of the Port Authority. Well, that's a big jump from that to these two towers and like 10 million square feet of commercial office space.
Yeah, it is a big jump. Yeah. It's also, though, a moment in which the city is reimagining itself as a finance, insurance, and real estate capital, and where we're really trying to lose. I mean, in a way, the World Trade Center moment of its planning and creation is a moment where the city feels that it may be losing some of its edge, and where it says, well, where can we go? What can we do? And the planners and oligarchs of the city more or less are of the same mind. They have tactical differences, but strategically they all basically think, we got to lose manufacturing. We got to get that out of here. And we got to bring in, you know, a symbolic economy. We need to bring in what the federal government calls the fire industries, more of the fire industries, finance, insurance, and real estate, which bleeds directly, by the way, to tourism, because then you create a city as a museum rather than as an actual working city. And what was ironic, of course, about it is that you have this vast real estate project taking place just at the point where we're on the brink of a cybernetic revolution that essentially decentralizes finance. So you don't really have a rationale for having that kind of a financial district anymore. It's fascinating. But you do end up losing a lot of manufacturing. You do end up losing the port. And you transform the city into, at least on one level, you change its sense of what its function is. And there was a moment where, when I was growing up, where New York's primary identity was that as a maritime city that made, transported, and financed things. Finance was a big part of the mix, always was. And not always, not, but it was after a certain point, after we kind of stole banking from Boston, you know, it kind of drifted here when we became this banking center. Then, you know, the mix was very rich, and it made for the possibility of tremendous, tremendous wealth here that could really spread around. I mean, we actually had a significant number of really of decent working class neighborhoods in Manhattan 25, 30 years ago, and they literally no longer exist, and we have an enormous gap income-wise now between working New Yorkers and people who are very wealthy here, and many of whom don't actually live here but just own property. And the World Trade Center moment kind of defines that hinge. To be fair, containerization of ports is coming up as well. Many cities lose their central port facilities, and those are externalized and put someplace else. But it's a question of how it's done, more than what was actually done. The how of it? Why did we decide that this particular approach to modernizing New York was the correct approach, or was the desirable or necessary approach? And you raised an interesting point before, which is that in a way, once you have a kind of unlimited power to create something, you kind of go like, well, someone's stopping me. Why don't we just do it? And I think once the Port Authority crossed the line and definitively sort of said, yeah, well, the port's all right, but, you know, bridges and tunnels are all right, but, like, real estate's much sexier. Once you cross that line and you have unlimited bonding power, it's kind of like, hey, why not?
Yeah.
So in a way, what you're talking about is kind of corruption, but it's not necessarily a venal kind of corruption. It's more just too much power in the wrong hands inevitably leads to this, whether people are virtuous or not. So, but you do have a very fundamental change in the life of the city. And another person who deserves several books or several movies is the head of the Port Authority. Robert Moses is extremely well known as the kind of master planner of New York for many, many years. But Austin Tobin, the director of the Port Authority, if there was a third tower, it should have been David Nelson and Austin. Austin Tobin, as head of the Port Authority for many years, and the man who really built it into a vast and powerful agency, a fantastic and interesting character who really was an Eminence Grise, a man behind the scenes who virtually never had a public conversation, but yet wielded tremendous, tremendous power over how the city was going to be shaped. Fascinating stuff.
In this hour, we're talking with Eric Darton. He's a cultural historian, fiction writer, native New Yorker, author of the novel Free City and many essays and stories that have been published many places. He's also taught Hunter College, Fordham University, Goddard College, New York University. He's the author of the book Divided We Stand that's subtitled A Biography of the World Trade Center. And it's about how the World Trade Center was built. And this was a book that was first published in 1999 and now has been republished. It is available in paper. Basic Books is the publisher. We do have some callers here, so let's get with them. Again, folks will help us if they can try to be brief here now that we're moving in our second half. We'll start out with someone who is in Rankin and calling on a cell phone. And this is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Great program. Time is short, so two quick observations and then a philosophical question for your guest. I was in New York back when I was in college back in the 70s, and my wife and I went back in the late 80s and again took the kids 2004. And the transformation of the city, your guest is quite right, from the 70s, it was one of those places that after you visited, you felt like you needed to take a shower. It was kind of like Taxi Driver. And the city really has reinvented itself much more, I don't say family-friendly, but much more of a conducive to tourism. It really cleaned up its act. I was quite impressed. I want to say, and your guests would know better than I would, I also thought that the property that the United Nations sits on was also donated by the Rockefellers, but I could be wrong on that. But my question for your guest to ponder is, given the scope and the breadth of the World Trade Center, if somebody did want to do us wrong, to attack this country, doesn't he think that perhaps it would be inevitable that they would attack the World Trade Center? The only other institution I can think of would be the U.S. Capitol. But, I mean, given the size of it, I mean, we went around in 2004 and after it was knocked down and just the amount of real estate donated to it was vast and the building itself was just it's unbelievable. And given the symbolism, I was wondering if you guys could speak on the inevitability of something like a 9/11 attack. And I'll listen off here. Thanks.
All right. Well, that certainly goes to the question of what the building represented, what it stood for, and the fact that I think in a lot of people's minds, clearly in the minds of the people that destroyed it, it did have tremendous symbolic significance.
Hmm. Yeah, I think probably whoever destroyed it probably knew us better than we did.
Hmm.
You know, had we been at any public event, a party or anything on September 10th, 2001, and been hanging out together and someone had said, so, Eric, what have you been up to? And I said, well, you know, a year or so ago, I published this book on the World Trade Center. They would have either tried to stifle a yawn or else their eyes would have glazed over and they would have kind of, you know. It's hard to imagine after 9/11 and in 10 years that have passed how absolutely not important these buildings were consciously in the hearts and minds of people. There were many reasons, and I allude to some of them in terms of the architectural weirdness of them and a whole bunch of other things. But, you know, the fact was that we did think of them, but we didn't think very much about them, and we certainly didn't think what they might symbolize, and we certainly had no idea what they would mean to us. Gone. And so I think that it's very curious, and one of the things I'm very interested in examining, and I do to some extent in the afterword to the book, I mean, the book is the Divided We Stand is the original 1999 text, but it's been framed to bring it into the moment. But I do examine why is it that now it's so clear that these buildings were of tremendous importance to us, you know, that this was like really a stab to an organ when these things came down. Why didn't we value them before? Why didn't we not understand what they meant? And I think it's because, to be honest with you, I think it's because we never really owned them. And there are many reasons why we never owned them. But I think in the same way that we, as a vast and powerful country, economically and militarily, have no idea of how we are, because we are the 300-pound gorilla. We just kind of don't get how people relate to the 300-pound gorilla, because we can't imagine being, you know, the 20-pound the 50-pound chimpanzee. I mean, we can't imagine what our scale is just so huge. And so I think that these buildings that Yamasaki gave us and the Port Authority gave us were very clear signs to us about what we valued, about what we had become, and that we had declared, in a sense, by building these buildings, we declared that we were ending history right here and right now, and that we were the masters of it. It was like if you look at the end of a score of a symphony or any musical piece, there's a double bar at the end, and it's like, this is it. We're done. You hit the dominant chord, that's it. And I think psychologically, I do not, by the way, believe that any of this, anything is inevitable. I mean, I do not believe it's all written. I think they did, in fact, strike the terrorists or whoever did this struck other places as well. And one of the planes potentially was on the way to the Capitol. But as a takedown of a society's internal sense of its own structure, this was a very powerful attempt at a takedown of the internal structure of the society. All the more powerful because we ourselves didn't recognize what it meant to us and what to me that was in a way the hideous and criminal genius of something like this. I would actually never have thought about that. It really actually takes a really sociopathic mind to actually do it. In a way, it's kind of like people who really go over to the dark side actually know how to get to people in a certain way that the rest of us just don't know how to do. Like they can mess with you on levels that you don't even realize are there. So it's a fascinating question that your listener asked. I don't really know, but I do know that had we been connected to the World Trade Center emotionally and psychologically, had we really owned it on a certain level, then we would be grieving for it differently than we are. We would our sense of loss would be a different one. If you lose a parent, for instance, not to go too far on with this, that you've had hardly any relationship with, or who have not been an easy person to communicate, often the grieving process is much, much longer than the parent you kind of got your stuff sorted out with. I mean, I've lost both of mine, and you know, I'm making it from my own life. Much easier for me to deal in the case of my, you know, a parent that I actually felt I had, we completed the relationship. And the one that I didn't have a complete relationship with, still with me.
It just, I'm glad we got to this point because I'm really fascinated by this question of how it is that the destruction of the buildings changed people's relationship to them. And cause them to, you know, think very differently about them. And I'm sure it's the case with you, and I'm sure the case with a lot of other people. And interestingly enough, we talked earlier on about the history of the book, and suddenly you found yourself after the towers were destroyed with all these people who wanted to talk with you. And in fact, there was one real wonderful quote in that you gave in one interview that I looked at. You said, "The book I had written as a provocation had become a source of comfort and centeredness." And I just thought, that, man, that's really what a remarkable reversal on so many levels.
Yeah, and it's deep, you know, just personally, because I taught for years, and this is one of the dangers of being a teacher is that the stuff you teach you're actually going to have to learn. And, you know, well, maybe not have to, but, you know, it might actually just come back around and get you. And I had always taught people that when they write something, they never know what its significance is going to be in the world. And most people, myself included, look at ourselves either through a telescope or through, you know, the wrong end of the telescope or the right end. The point of view to see what we're doing is just too big or too small. We don't have a sense of ourselves in scale. And so, you know, when we write something or when you put something out in the world, you never know what the world will make of it, and you never know what history will make of it. And so that sense of not of continuing to do your work and continuing to write but not really being in control. I mean, I was fine, you know, kind of in the immediate aftermath. In a sense, or at least I felt like I was fine. I was probably just in shock. But when I did go up to the country almost a week after the towers were destroyed, someone had just bought the last copy in Barnes & Noble's and came to the friend's house where we were staying with the book in her hands and asked me to sign it. And I realized that this was, in fact, the closest thing that we were going to get to, most of us were going to get to putting our hands on some material remnant. And that was it's extraordinary. And in a way, what is so wonderful about this from a spiritual standpoint is that the stories that we tell and that the ways in which we internalize these places of the heart, they may not survive us. Usually our architecture does survive us. Usually we go before the architecture does. In this case, the architecture, these buildings never outlived many of the people who grew up with them. Yet, when we have a full engagement with our lives, with our buildings, with our places, then we are able to internalize those stories deeply. It's a very, very interesting. To me, it's very interesting because it gives you a different kind of strength to go on than a kind of strength where you either have to retaliate or get paid. I'm not saying that these things are not necessarily appropriate, but I'm saying that there has to be an internal reckoning with what has been gained and what has been lost in any of these situations. And when you write something, you never know what's going to happen. I'm telling you, it's really spooky. I mean, because I preached for years, hey, guys, just write it and let the world figure out what to do with it. And then it happened to me, and it was like, oh. You know, and in a way, it's not really about me at all because I just borrowed a whole bunch of stuff from history, and it's like, you know, I mean, it was just there. It was all there. You know, it's like there was nothing. I mean, if I did anything that was special, it was simply notice something that was there and put a bunch of dots together and say, hey, by the way, this is one way you could draw these dots. I mean, you could make a bunch of different constellations, but here's one way you could do it. And as it happens, because the World Trade Center was so deeply unowned by people on many levels, it ended up being basically the one artifact text. I wish, in my heart of hearts, the 20 people had written books about this, because now I feel, you know, my book is, I think it's good that it took 8 years to finally write and get published, because it had a chance to go through many phases. And if we were going to do one book on the World Trade Center, I'm glad that someone wrote a book that was that deeply researched and that felt through. But I wish there had been 20, because I think it would have given us 20 before books is what I mean, because I think that would have given us more. Just having 20 different minds examine the same thing would have been a good idea.
Yeah. We are talking this morning with Eric Darton. Again, his book is Divided We Stand, A Biography of the World Trade Center. It's published by Basic Books. And again, as we have explained, it's a book that it was first published in 1999 and now has been republished with a new introduction. Questions welcome. We do have about 10 minutes left here. We have a caller in Charleston, line 2. We'll go there. Hello.
Hi. Thank you very much. I think I heard you touch on this, but I wanted to ask explicitly. There's been some documentaries that say that when the trade towers fell, they were actually part of the public domain, but that the insurance policy on it was received by private entities. And again, this is kind of conspiratorial from a documentary or two, but I'm just curious if you could talk about, separate some of the truth from fiction there. Who owned the tower when it actually fell, and then how was it insured and who collected? Thank you very much.
For asking that. It's an interesting question. I'll answer it as succinctly as I can, or I'll do my best to answer it as succinctly as I can by going back to the origins of this very quickly. The area that the footprint of the World Trade Center, was taken by eminent domain by the Port Authority for a public purpose, which the World Trade Center was not, but they said it was, and it stuck in court. And there was a commercial neighborhood down there called Radio Row. It was the Tri-State Electronics Center. People in cities, centers of commerce, congregate. And Radio Row was a very important place, but it was also, you know, dispensable as far as the powers that be was concerned. And there was also a wholesale market there. There were a whole bunch of what were considered obsolete functions. So when the Port Authority took it by eminent domain, they actually took those 16 square blocks away from the city. The city really couldn't do anything about it because a larger, bigger, more sovereign entity, the state of New York and the state of New Jersey combined as the Port Authority, had said, hey, this isn't the city anymore. So what happened was that this then became Port Authority. If you're dumb enough to go down there and smoke dope, you're going to be arrested by a Port Authority cop. However, the city maintained, as of you know, ancient legal custom, the right to the streets. And to assemble the World Trade Center site meant creating a gigantic super block. So the city was able to bargain for what's called pilots, which is payments in lieu of taxes. So in order for the city to give permission for them to assemble the super block, the city could cut a better deal on what would have been taxes on its real estate had it remained its real estate. To cut way forward, by the time, right before the World Trade Center is destroyed, only a few months before the World Trade Center is destroyed, the buildings themselves are net leased to a developer named Larry Silverstein, who is also worth his own book and who, you know, anyone can Google him or Wikipedia him. It's very interesting stuff how this all fell out. He's also been the recipient of billions of dollars of money that the Congress allocated to New York City, 20-something billion dollars that came for redevelopment of that area in the aftermath, much of which has been used to make office buildings, and some of which has been used for transportation. But, well, there you are. So what happened here is that you basically have this enormous amount of the city taken away from the city, and then the Port Authority decides to net lease this for 100 years to a private developer. They own the land, supposedly, although the city, on some weird level, retains some. There's all this weird disputed property stuff. Silverstein, one of the conditions of his buying this, or at least net leasing it, is that he has to insure it privately, right? You don't want to have a Port Authority, and by virtue of that, the people of New York and New Jersey holding the bag if anything happens. So he has to find private insurers for this. So he does, and it's a very Byzantine complex thing. I can easily see how pretty much any aspect of the Port Authority could easily lend itself to all sorts of what we call conspiracy theories, which I don't see as conspiracy. I just see them as alternate theories. And the reason that there's so many alternate theories is because there's so little reliable information, because no one's really sure quite who owns what down there. One thing we can say is that, like, $20 billion worth of federal money has poured into that site and in that area right around there, and $2-point-something billion so that Goldman Sachs could build a tower across the street. So, I mean, you don't have to be – I mean, there's a lot out there, and I encourage anyone who wants to spend weeks and months and years looking at the web and figuring the story out for themselves. But one of the curious things that happened is that the World Trade Center area ceased to be part of New York City. However, the fire department of New York City did rush in. I mean, it was, and there's a deep, deep and bitter irony, which is that many of the uniformed services, terrible, terrible toll that was taken on lots of different levels. But the New York City Fire Department went in to do what they had to do. And these buildings, because they were built by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey and not by New York City, were not subject to New York City fire codes or building codes. And our firemen had to deal with buildings that were not built to code. And New York City fire code is very strict, even now when we have nobody to inspect. I mean, even now the builders tend to try, at least the ethical ones, so the semi-ethical ones, try to build buildings that will be, you know, sustainable during fires. Well, the Port Authority just didn't have to do that. They just rewrote the rules. They were engineers. They could do whatever they wanted. And so you really enter into, with the World Trade Center, you enter into really peculiar issues of sovereignty, like who really owns what. There's still some question as to who actually owns various bits of it down there.
Well, is that
it's really weird. I mean, you're entering into a world like where it's like Alice in Wonderland.
I wish that we had another hour because, you know, I'm really interested in hearing what you'd have to say about the rebuilding. And I wonder, you know, in spite of the fact that after the attacks that so many people and the governor and the mayor and the president all said they were determined to rebuild, essentially for about 5 years, nothing happened. And now there is construction. But, you know, they rushed so that the memorial would be open in time for the anniversary. The One Trade Center, the building that they're building, it's not finished yet, and it won't be finished until next year. It'll be a couple of years till the transportation hub is ready to go. There's a museum that will maybe open next year. I mean, why did it take so long before? I mean, I'm sure building a big building is complicated and it does take time, but why does it take so long for anything really to happen?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons, and I don't really know all of them, because my interest primarily was in how did these extraordinary structures manifest themselves in Lower Manhattan. I have been, to be honest with you, much less engaged with the redevelopment process. For one reason, because I just don't find it as compelling a story. I find this much more compelling, the power play and the land grab and the changing of the whole city's identity around one sort of symbolic site. I find that much more interesting. However, I can kind of answer. One thing is that by the time you get layers and layers of all sorts of Byzantine stuff where things are insured and reinsured and someone has control of this and someone has control of that, and you have the Deutsche Bank building, which was a neighboring structure that was severely damaged and that was this gigantic toxic Superfund site because it didn't fall down. It would have been better if it had, because it ended up being this just enormous, like, horrible thing that had to be taken down floor by floor by floor painstakingly. So there were all sorts of things that kind of, you know, a lot of people want to point the finger, like, why did it take so long? Well, it took so long because, you know, you've got, like, it's like, I mean, it's like, why does it take the Three Stooges so long to make breakfast? You know, I mean, well, because they're the Three Stooges, and because and they're trying to make breakfast in a kitchen that's like 2 feet by 2 feet. I mean, it would be comedy if it were, you know, the timing was different. But you also have, for me, a larger overarching factor. And the larger overarching factor is you didn't need 10 million square feet of office space in Lower Manhattan in 1966, and you sure as hell don't need, like, 5 point whatever billion feet of new office space in Lower Manhattan in 2011, 12, 13, 14. You just don't need it. And so there's no, the problem is there's no fundamental raison d'etre, there, you know, reason for it to be there. And I actually think that if a project has a reason to be, people kind of do it. It sort of makes its own. It's like when a baby's ready to come out, it's like, hey, I'm here, right? And just, you know, everything stops. Baby comes. And with this, it was like, why are we, would someone tell me why we're doing this again? Oh, yeah, we're putting up more office towers. Oh, yes, we have to put up a symbol to show that we're still here, that we haven't been vanquished. Oh, yeah, well, somebody, but there's a million ways that as a culture we could show that we're resilient, that we're freedom-loving, that we're intact as a democracy. There's a million ways you could do that. Building a, having 5 or 6 stars build a bunch of architecture in Lower Manhattan doesn't really do that. What will happen, though, which I think is against all the kind of mega visuals, is that the reflecting pools that are basically in the footprints of the original two towers, Tower 1 and Tower 2, North and South Towers, I think those spaces are going to be extraordinary. And I think that they, in my view, are kind of the raison d'etre for the whole project. People are going to go there and just feel something really amazing.
I'm so sorry to have to jump in on you. We have to stop. I want to say thanks so much. Eric Darton is our guest. And it's a quite interesting story, certainly for people, as I said, who are interested in architecture, urban development. You will want to take a look at his book. It's titled Divided We Stand, A Biography of the World Trade Center, now out with a new introduction and afterward by Basic Books. And also take a look at Free City. I think that's a pretty interesting novel that he's also written.
Would you mind just saying the website? Because there's a living archive of material that didn't make it into the book that was compiled since 1999 that people might find very interesting.
Sure, give it out.
Okay, it's www.ericdarton.net.
.net, all right.
And it's the living archive, and there's no better thing than to come and see for yourself.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Eric. We appreciate it.
It's been a delight. Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. We first broadcast the show on September 1st. You can check up on the schedule, see what we'll do in the weeks ahead, and also listen to past programs. And there are many shows there for you, ready to go anytime that you're ready to listen. You just go to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
Coming up in the next part of Focus, we have another archive, this one from October, a conversation that I had with science writer Dava Sobel. We talked about her recent book, A More Perfect Heaven, How Copernicus Revolutionized the Cosmos, and indeed is about, in part, about the life of Nicholas Copernicus, his ideas, and how it is that he was persuaded to publish them by a young German mathematician named Georg Rheticus. It's all about how it is they came together and how, indeed, their meeting changed the way that we see the world. That is the program that you'll hear in hour number two. As we usually do at this point, we'll take a break so we can bring you an update on the commodity markets and some news from National Public Radio, so stay tuned.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM,
now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview. Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Worries about the global economy, as well as speculative selling on this shortened trading week with Thanksgiving off and then back to the marketplace on Friday, is weighing on all grain futures. They're all down double digits for the most part all across the trading floor. And Chicago futures falling to their lowest level in nearly 5 months in the wheat, in particular pressured by the weak demand, worries about the economy, technical selling as well, and market falling below current suspected support levels. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas,